that in alcohol and drugs and in gambling, one can totally abstain. In sex addiction, one cannot totally abstain because it's a normal sexual activity and a normal sexual drive. So the similarity of sex addiction is much closer to food addiction. One cannot avoid eating. The problem is that when a person loses control of eating and eats compulsively rather than for nutritional needs, that becomes self-destructive, obesity, and its complications. So a compulsive, will say what one young man said to me the other day. He's a man of about 45 and he weighs about 300 pounds. And he said, I've tried to stop, but it doesn't help. Every time I walk by something and there's some food, I put it in my mouth. So there is, I think, a similarity. And yet, people in 12-step program for food addiction have successfully restrained themselves, have successfully contained their weight. But obviously it's different than the others. Now, we don't know in any of the addictions, we don't know the causes of them. We don't know why one person can take a L'chaim and nothing happens. Why one person can take a pain pill for some pain that the doctor has prescribed and nothing happens. Another person takes a drink and loses control in one of the alcoholism patterns or gets addicted to drugs. So we don't understand whether it's genetic. That still remained a mystery. But we have to deal with the phenomenon. Here it is. There is loss of control. Now, why we would ask a question, or like any person who suffers, and if he wants to blame God for it, turns to God and says, why me? Right? And you can do this with anything. My problem now with severe back pain and with spinal, I could say, why me? But it's a foolish question to ask. We have faith that God knows what he's doing, and somehow or other, a pattern of his wisdom, this fits in somehow, which I don't understand, and I have to accept that on the basis of my faith. Well, we don't know why some people have a compulsive sex urge and others have a normal sex life and normal sexual activity. We don't have that. But what we got to realize is the Talmud says a person is always accountable. Unless a person is totally psychotic and has no contact with reality at all, every person has accountability and every person should be able to control one's behavior. If we have lost control and we don't know why we have lost control, we have to find out from those people who have had a similar problem and have established control to find out how they do it. And you usually do not get the answer from psychologists or psychiatrists. You usually get the answer from other people in recovery. This is true in alcohol addiction, it's true in drug addiction, it's true in gambling addiction, and it shouldn't be true in sexual addiction as well. There are people who are in SA or one of the related programs and no longer act out, no longer look at pornography, but they still have a struggle. But every addict has a struggle. And the struggle that we have, that the addict has, is so much similar to the struggle that every person has, because we are created with animal bodies, and we have every desire and every impulse that an animal has. So we have hate, we have aggression, we have lust, we have them all. However, we were not created to be animals. The animals are not, an animal cannot decide I'm going to diet today. An animal cannot frustrate or deny any physiological drive. What an animal wants to, feels it wants to do, it is going to do. Right? Unless there's some sort of punishment involved that stops it. But otherwise, an animal will go whatever the drive is. The human being must be different. We must establish controls. And it's a mistake to say, I can't control. The Talmud says something very interesting. The Talmud says that a person's yetzer hara, quote, evil instinct, or animalistic instincts. A person's animal instincts are so strong that a person could never control them by oneself without the help of God. So, continuum, right? We are all to some degree powerless unless we enlist another source of power to help us control. And we must make the first move and pray for divine help. It is told of the great sage, the Chofetz Chaim. No one ever saw him in anger. But he used to come into the shul at night, at midnight, and open up the Torah Ark and used to cry bitterly, praying for God to take away his feelings of anger. He never manifested anger, but he could not control the feeling of anger if somebody provoked him or offended him. Right? And he didn't like that feeling, but was not able to do anything about it. And so he prayed intensively for divine help. And this is one of the things we must do. It's a struggle, and it's a struggle that we're not going to overcome easily, but we can overcome it. And it's a struggle that, unfortunately, is going to last us for indefinitely. However, we don't think of it terms indefinitely because that's going to be too much to handle. So we think of one day at a time, or sometimes we have to think of 1 hour at a time, and sometimes we have to think of 15 minutes at a time. But we ask God for his help, and we have to pray intensively. Maybe we should pray like the Chofetz Chaim did at the open ark, praying and crying for your divine help. I guess the intensity of prayer has to do with how effective it is going to be and how effective the divine response is going to be. So we then get help from other people, our sponsors, other people who have had a similar problem and have found ways to deal with it. And that's the strength of the program. And of course, once we achieve some degree of control, some degree of mastery with the help of the God and with the help of the program, then we're at the 12th and we try to help others overcome it. And when you work with others, that is probably one of the greatest sources of strength. Right? It's more than just a motto that you can't have it unless you give it away. Because doing the 12th step and helping others with a similar problem that we have gives us enormous courage and enormous strength to fight with it. So, that's my initial pitch. Now I'd like to hear comments.
Okay, Rabbi Twersky, thank you very much. Certainly appreciate the inspiration and insights that you shared. Of course, we're, as addicts, we're looking for hope. We have questions. It's frustrating to be labeled as an addict. I'll open up the call to questions in a little bit. I do have some questions that were sent beforehand by email. So, Hevra, just hold tight while we go through some of these questions. I won't be using names because the call is being recorded. So when I do unmute the line, you don't have to share your name unless you're willing to, or if it's anonymous name anyhow, it may not matter. So the question is as follows from one of our strugglers, is that he has an observation that he says, I would grab onto the idea that Chazal tells us, Sheva Yapol Tzadikim V'Kayim. In other words, Tzadik falls 7 times and gets up. I would struggle in battle, but ultimately feel good that I was a warrior in Hashem's army. To make a long question short, I realize the 12 steps have improved other areas of my life, but I've since labeled myself as an addict, and now I fall more frequently and without the feeling of fight that I had previously. How do I address this paradox that is bugging me and interfering with the closeness to Hashem that I felt I had before joining the program?
Well, you know, one of you know that in addiction we have stinking thinking, right? And the addiction will use any method to keep the addiction going. It's one of the tactics of the addiction to say, why try? It's useless. You're not going to succeed anyway, so you might as well have the pleasure of the addictive activity. There are so many rationalizations, and I think this is just another rationalization of I've called myself an addict, and that sort of seems to quote-unquote justify my behavior. No, being an addict does not justify one's behavior. What happens is that the addict must take greater precautions in regard to sexual behavior and sexual exposure than a person who is not an addict. And for example, we're told avoid people, places, and things, right? Two of patients who graduated from Gateway Rehabilitation Center were walking along the street together one day when one of them said, hey, I got to cross the street because there's a tavern on this side. So the other guy said, you're crazy. Why can't you just walk by the tavern? So he said, no, I'm not taking any chances. The guy who walked across the street remained sober, and the guy who felt secure enough to walk by the tavern ultimately relapsed. When we realize our vulnerability, we have to take even greater precautions. So a person who has a sexual addiction may have to keep his eyes away from certain billboards, right? From pictures and not pornography, but pictures that are photos that are not considered pornography, but nevertheless have nudity, right? And Mesillas Yesharim says in his introduction that our life is one long series of tests, right? We are constantly being challenged, constantly being tested. Now, why that is so, I have no idea. God did not let us into his secrets as to why he created man that way. But our mission is to overcome possibly destructive tendencies and live according to a code that we believe is right. So the fact that the individual has now identified himself as an addict, the addictive thinking will use that in order to lower his resistance and say, okay, you're an addict now, so it's almost okay to do it because you're an addict. No way. That's stinking thinking.
Well, Rabbi, along those lines, the gentleman, the guy seemed to can fall into a state of depression with that recognition, that admission, and that focus on, well, this is going to be who I am my entire lifetime. Life is just a series of tests. How does one overcome that draw into depression and despair?
Well, first of all, there is never any reason for despair. It's good that you talked about us as strugglers, because that's what we're doing. And each of us has challenges. So right now I'm dealing with the challenge of severe back pain from spinal stenosis. And I cannot use any potent medication because I'm afraid of addiction. So I suffer with the pain. Why me? I have no idea. Am I in despair? No. Am I depressed that I can't walk well? Yes. Anytime you have any kind of discomfort, there is understandably a depression. But if we make a, hey, look, this is my lot in life, and I've got to lead as constructive and as happy a life as possible, in spite of the difficulty that I have. Despair is a tool of the addiction. There's never any reason for despair. That's why we share our hope and courage.
Excellent. Okay. On to the next question. The gentleman asks, in my humble opinion, a lot of the Yidden that come into the program are more based on a guilty bottom rather than a consequential deadly rock bottom. So how can I really come to powerlessness with the craving that this is, that's this hard? It's a little hard for me to understand the question, but the gist of it is as follows, is that he, perhaps he's admitting himself and feels that he hears from other guys in SA, especially the from SA meetings, and perhaps on this call, the men are on primarily as a guilty bottom rather than a rock bottom. And here oftentimes in meetings or in the literature how we have to reach rock bottom in order to have results or success in this program. Can you please address that?
Well, I think we ought to realize that there are two types of guilt. There's a healthy guilt and there's a pathological guilt. Healthy guilt is when I've done something wrong, I should feel bad about it. It should discourage me from doing it again in order to avoid the pain of guilt. It should lead me to do whatever amends I can do to rectify the situation. That is healthy guilt. There's pathological guilt. There are people who feel guilty for no valid reason at all, or they have what they think is a valid reason and it's not. And they go around with feelings of guilt which are destructive, because guilt, pathological guilt, drains a person's energy, and we need all the energy that we can muster to survive our addiction. So I don't believe that there should be such thing as a guilty bottom. I believe that a person who is trying one's utmost, sincerely trying one's utmost to overcome any problem, right, is doing all that God can expect of him. Right? Now, we've got to be careful to say, yeah, I'm doing everything I can, when it's not true. Right? But if one is really doing everything within one's power, then there's no reason to feel guilt. Right? So, yes, things happened that I did that were wrong. Things happened that I did that were unhealthy. I am trying to do my best to overcome it, and I'm asking God's forgiveness. So I don't believe in a guilt bottom. I think rock bottom is when our behavior, the loss of control of our behavior leads to consequences that are destructive in our lives.
Okay. Rabbi, along those lines, we'll often hear from men how that they are in the program because their wives have forced them in the programs, their rabbis forced them into the program, but they would not have made the choice to be in the program. What can they gain from being in this program, carrying a load of resentment towards being forced into the program?
Last week, I talked with a gentleman who's now retired. I took him out of jail in 1973. He's 40 years clean and sober. Initially, he had a great deal of resentment. He had a resentment for being put in jail. He had a resentment for being forced into treatment. But the resentment for being forced into treatment gradually wears off when a person realizes that treatment is life-saving and the tough love is life-saving. You know, they tell me that if a person is drowning and somebody jumps in to pull him out of the water, that the person who's drowning may be in such panic that he fights off the rescuer. And what will happen is that they'll both end up drowning. So sometimes what the rescuer might have to do is give him a sharp blow to the head and knock him out, and then pull him out. Now, it is not a nice thing to do, to give somebody a sharp blow to the head and render him unconscious. if that's what it takes to save a person's life, then that's what it takes. So we may have resentment for being forced into the program, but hopefully if we have a modicum of sense, we'll realize that without having been forced into the program, we would have gone down the tubes to a total self-destruction.
Excellent. Good. All right. Another question is around the concept of Bechira. Do I have Bechira or not? What is my Hishtadlus in regards to powerlessness and the way the program tells us about powerlessness? How does that compare to what we learn in Torah about Bechira?
Right. Look, let me give you a very bizarre example, okay? But it'll serve the purpose for teaching purposes. An addict is about to shoot up with heroin. And he feels, like always, he has no control over it. Guy comes in, points a gun at him, and he says, put that needle down or I'll shoot you. You know that person is going to put the needle down. Why? Because he doesn't want to get killed. So, does he have Bechira? Of course he has Bechira. If he did not have Bechira, he would shoot himself up, in spite of the fact that the other guy is going to kill him. Right? So, now that's a bizarre example. But if we truly realize the destructive nature of our addictive behavior, whether it's gambling or sex or whatever, and we realize that if we give into it, there are going to be terrible consequences, right? If we can genuinely feel that way, right, then we'll be discouraged from doing it. So the only question is, yes, of course we have Bechira. Obviously, when I see something tasty and I decide, you know, I better not eat it for whatever reason, I don't want to kill my appetite for supper, all right? I can do that, where a person who's a compulsive doesn't do that, not that he can't do it, right, but he doesn't do that. We both have Bechira. He is not using his Bechira. Sometimes it's, again, his challenge is much greater than mine. I have no problem walking away from a piece of cake, right? Where he must use every bit of strength to walk away from the compulsion. So, and you say, well, why did God do this to me? I have no idea. Right? I have often said that if God had given me the ability to designed the world, there are some things that I would have eliminated, right? Many kinds of suffering, right, I would have eliminated. But God did not give me the ability to design the world. He designed the world the way he wanted, and much of it is beyond our understanding. But I've got to accept I have this temptation which God gave to me, and it's my mission to overcome it. This is my mission on earth. This is what I was created to do. Another person was created to do something else. My mission is to overcome my addiction. So, we have Bechira. And the Hishtadlus means the attempt to control it, anything and everything. There is, obviously, nothing is guaranteed. Reading the Psalms every day, really praying intensively. And I've seen intensive prayer, and I must tell you that my prayer is nowhere near as intensive as some of the prayers that I've seen people have, and I'm jealous and envious of them, but I've got to try harder. I've got to try harder to improve the quality of my prayer. So, yes, we all have Bechira. If a person doesn't have Bechira, then we go to the concept of irresistible impulse, which is an absurd defense, because it means that a person can go shoot people and say, can't help it, I had the impulse to do it. So we cannot buy a resistible impulse. And since we don't buy a resistible impulse, that means I am responsible because I have the ability to control my behavior.
That's excellent, Rabbi. It's the first time I've heard of the term irresistible impulse as it compares to powerlessness. Thank you on that. Another question revolves around what can God do about my powerlessness?
what can God do? God can do anything and everything. As to why he does some things and why he does not, we don't understand. I believe that God was in control of the weather. Right? And, yes, the fact that he's paralyzed our town with snow, I have no idea why he did that. On the other hand, I also don't understand why he allows tsunamis and why he allows earthquakes. Those are questions, mysteries that are only known to him. My own feeling is that I know that I have had people to look up to, great pious people, actually saintly people, who were far brighter than I am. And they had all the questions that I have. Right? And yet they remained faithful. Yeah? For example, my uncle, the Bobever Rebbe, was in the Holocaust. Lost a wife and two children. Lost a father and two brothers. Right? Went through the unspeakable horrors of the Holocaust. One could easily understand why a person would come out and say, I can't believe in God if God allowed this to happen. But he came out with intense religious feelings and became a religious leader of tens of thousands of people. So we don't know why these things happen. Is it just? Not in my sense it isn't just, but there is a bracha that we say when adversity happens, and that is Baruch Dayan Emes, that we accept the judgment of God as being, and that his justice is true, even though I don't see it that way.
Okay, thank you. Another question, Rabbi, is around, is my disease an onus, and I'm not really accountable?
Well, I think we go to back to where we said before. I don't believe that it's an onus. That goes back to the concept of irresistible impulse. This young man who I saw the other day weighs 300 pounds. He's about 45 years old. And he tells me, I can't walk up a flight of stairs. I have to stop three times on the way. Right? And so it limits him in so many ways, and he realizes what it's doing to him. And yet, if he walks by and he sees chocolate or cookies, he's going to go that route. He's not an onus. Right? He could control it, just like other people are doing it. And in fact, that's what the value of the 12-step program is. Anybody who says he can't control will walk into a room and there are dozens of people there who were in a similar situation where they felt that they can't control, but they did it. And one of the things that I want to point out here is why it is so important to attend 12-step meetings. Of course, it's important for myself. It's important to help me control my addiction. But there's another thing that we should remember, that if you walk into a room and there are 15 people who are in recovery, you have 15 models and 15 sources of reinforcement and courage to help you in your struggle. And if there are 16 people, then you have 16 sources. Every person who goes to a 12-step meeting who's in recovery, just by being there, doesn't even have to open his mouth. Just by being there is a source of strength and courage to all who want the recovery from addiction.
Excellent, excellent. Okay, thank you. Just a few more questions, Rabbi, please. This gentleman asks, if the approach, and this is just to set you up, Rabbi, this is around the mantra that we have, let go and let God, okay? The question is this, if the approach of the 12 steps is let go and let God, how do we reconcile that with Chazal's approach of viewing our struggle with the Yetzirah as a war, Melchemes HaYetzer? There are a wealth of sources referring to the dealings with the Yetzirah as a battle. In Jewish Hashkafa, we constantly hear about fighting the Yetzirah. True, Chazal says we need Hashem's help to succeed in this battle, but isn't this Torah saying it's supposed to be a constant fight? And how does this reconcile with the 12 steps suggestion to let go and let God?
We have to understand what means let go, right? The let go is really a restatement of the Serenity Prayer. Accept that which I cannot change, and have the courage to change that which I can. Let go simply means don't try and change the unchangeable. Let go of it. As long as you can still do something, for heaven's sake, do it. If there's anything that you can do for whatever, not only an addiction, anything that you can do constructively, do it. But if you run out of what you can do, then what alternative do you have? When people say, I can't let go, I say, don't. Don't let go. You don't have that option. Right? If it's a reality, right, and it's not a changeable reality, then you've got to let go. Well, what happens if I let go? Well, the logical thing is that if you have any kind of faith at all right, I can't do anything, right? So I'm going to let God. Now, let me point out something very interesting to you, because it served as a major teaching to me. My nephew told me that he and he asked for help. The person who took over by remote was someplace in India and told him, keep your hands off the mouse, right? And I'll take over the control of your computer. Well, somewhere or other, my nephew had the urge that he had to move the mouse over something, and the guy said to him, look, you want to handle it? Go ahead. Then I'll stay off of it, right? You want me to handle it? Keep your hands off of it. So when he told me that, I said, you know, sometimes God is saying to us, you want me to handle it? Let me. Yeah. I had my attorney, who was a recovering cocaine addict, once said to me, there is no way that I could have recovered by my own effort. I know that God did it. The only thing that the program helped me do is I got out of his way. Right. I think that's an important statement, that sometimes we may do things that we think are right but are actually obstructive to our recovery. And if the 12-step program helps us get rid of those obstructions, right, then of course, that's if we let go of them, then of course, then we can let God do it. So I don't see any conflict between the hashkafa of it's a lifelong battle. But a lifelong battle means that there's still things we can do about it, right? So there's things that I can do about it when I'm 25, and things that I can do about it when I'm 85, right? That may be at a different level, right? But as long as there's something that I can do about it, then I have the obligation to do it, and that's the battle part. But when I've exhausted everything that I can do and I no longer can do anything, right, then I have to let go, right? And I have to let go. When I let go, my faith is that there's somebody going to take over when I let go.
Thank you. Good. I loved your mushroom about the computer tech in India controlling, you know, my computer. I've seen that before, and it just baffles me, and it's a perfect muscle for what you just shared about let go and let God. Thanks on that. Another question from a gentleman, just as preface, is someone who's been in the program for quite some time, a few cycles already, and is acknowledging his frustration as a chronic slipper. So he says, as an addict, I understand that I have a choice every day to use the tools of the program and stay sober or give up, throw in the towel, which usually leads me to acting out. My question is, once I start going down the road of not using the program tools and the feelings of hopelessness begin to kick in, a situation I've unfortunately been in too many times as a chronic slipper, do I have a choice, Bahira, as I'm rolling down that hill into hell? It sure does not feel like I do, and looking forward to your response.
You know, one of the reasons that it's so important to attend many meetings, it's possible that you can attend 78 meetings and not get what you need for yourself. But at the 79th meeting, you'll hear it. Right? There are many chronic slippers. One of the people who helped me in my education of alcoholism was initially sober for 3 years, and he slipped. And then he was sober for 2 years, and he slipped. And then he was sober for 3 years, and he slipped. And then he became sober for 37 years until he died. Addiction is fraught with slipping. Right? But one of my examples for the attitude towards slipping had to do with a day that I had to send off a registered letter to the post office, but it was sub-zero weather, my car was frozen, I couldn't start it. It was only about 5 blocks to the post office, so I decided to walk. Now, the streets were icy, so I walked very carefully. But in spite of my caution, when I was about 3 blocks into the way to the post office, I slipped and fell. Fortunately, I didn't break anything, but I got a pretty bad bruise. Right? Now, at that point, if somebody would have said, "Oh, you slipped. You're back home now." I said, "No way." Right? I'm three-fifths of the way there. I'm more than half of the way there. Right? You cannot take away from me the progress that I've made. I think that even a chronic slipper should realize that every bit of sobriety that and every bit of clean time that one has had adds up and can be used for a strength for further recovery. Certainly, in terms of teshuva, if a person did teshuva for whatever wrong behavior he did, and then relapsed, his initial teshuva is not taken away from him. That reward is permanent. That merit is permanent. So, having slipped does not mean you're back at square one. And we have to, the other thing, you better believe that after I got up from that fall on the ice, that I was much more careful how I was walking, right? Which means that if we slip, we have to take a look, and you know, there are programs for relapsers. Gorski's book on staying sober is an excellent source for avoiding the problems of relapse. And what we have to look at, where was my mistake, right? Was I not attending enough meetings? Was I not contacting my sponsor? Was I not doing a ongoing inventory? The program works. There's only one thing I want to mention here about the program. You know, I don't like to tamper with anything in AA because I admire it so greatly. But there's one statement that I think can be dangerous, and that is, half measures avail us nothing. The danger in that is that a person may say, "Oh, half measures are no good, but three-quarter measures are good." Right? And I say, no, three-quarter measures are no good either. Right? Recovery requires 100% participation. Right? And it means that if a person can say, I'll do 90% of the program, that'll never work. It's 100% or nothing. Right? So if the program requires X number of meetings, then that's what you got to do. Frequent contact with the sponsors, 12-step work, ongoing inventory. So if you keep up and you do it 100% of the time, right, then you'll find out, well, what happened that I slipped? Where was I remiss? And we'll usually find where we was remiss. And so then we have to make sure that we don't repeat that negligence again. And then we can avoid the next slip.
Rabbi continued, thanks for that. I tell the guys oftentimes that recovery is not a spectator sport. You know, much like you go to a big sports stadium and you see 90,000 people in the stadium, well, there's only 22 guys on the field that are actually going to score any points or win the game. The rest of us, the 98,980 or 78, we're not going to be scoring any points. So to reinforce what you're saying, recovery really is not a spectator sport, right, Rabbi?
Right, and it requires like any sport, right? If you really watch the excellent athletes, right, and watch what they're doing, right, you see how much effort and how much skill and how much intense goes into it, because they have this enormous desire to win, right? And that's what we have to do in recovery.
The question that I have for you, Rabbi, in my studies, I love looking at different sources in Torah and in the Siddur and different sources, and I found a great deal of sources that are really, really in alignment in Torah through Hasidus. And of course, I'm singing to the choir here, right? Preaching to the choir yourself. And it occurred to me, you've been saying the word recovery so many times, and I've come to ask, well, what am I recovering? If my goal is recovery, what am I recovering? So I would just like to hear if the rabbi has a take on that, please.
I'm not sure that I understand the question. You see,
let me explain it this way. If our goal is recovery, then what am I recovering? What did I lose that I need to be in recovery, that I need to recover? It's like something was lost, and I need to recover it. I've lost it, and I need to find it. I need to recover it.
I'm not so sure that the philology is important. We know what recovery means, and I don't mean, it's not like recovering something that was lost. I don't think that's a fair analogy, because I don't think it's a question of we're getting back something that was lost. Recovery means it's simply as another condition, any other illness, getting restored to one's health. But I must bring up this point. Participation in the 12-step program is great. Right? It's as vital to a person's life as a person who has diabetes and must take appropriate treatment for diabetes and can then live a healthy, normal life. But the person's goal in life is not to recover from diabetes, right? His goal, his goal in life is whatever one decides one goal in life is. For example, in Yiddishkeit, we believe the goal in life is somehow to develop a closer relationship with God, right? And to try to eliminate everything that interferes with that. That is my goal. Now, it may be that I'm diabetic, right? So I have to do everything to try and treat and overcome diabetes, because that stands in the way of my relationship with God, because if I'm going to be sick and weak, then I won't be able to do the kinds of things that will help get closer to God. And I think that's true of recovery from addiction. My goal in terms of recovery is to abstain from the addictive behavior and to lead a constructive life. But then what about, what's my constructive life? What's my ultimate purpose? And that is a question of hashkofa, which every individual has to deal with personally. What is my goal in life? Staying sober is clearly important, just as treating my diabetes is clearly important if I want to live, right? But recovering from diabetes is not the diabetic's goal in life.
Wow. Rabbi, I've exhausted the questions that were sent to me. I'm going to unmute the line, and maybe if the Rav would allow another couple of questions right from the Hevra. But there is a warning here. I don't know what's going to happen when I unmute the line, how much static or background noise there will be. If there's too much, I will remute the line. So just please stay with me. Okay, I have a mute where if you do a *6, you can unmute yourself if you have a question for the Rav.
Yes, I have a question, Ray Frisky.
Yes.
Yes, please.
Hi, thank you. Being involved with SA, let's say, over a dozen years, about 2 years ago, not wanting to continue going to meetings because I'm not working the program. I'm sitting in this circle, but I'm not working the program.
A little bit louder. 2 years ago?
Yeah, just Yeah, just being over a dozen years in the program, about 2 years ago, I just decided I'm not going to SA meetings anymore. I'm calling on the phone, yes, but it's just I'm not working the program. I'm sitting in the circles, but I'm not working the program. So my question is, even in school, even in work, just this easygoing, not applying myself, even in learning, even in my marriage, I'm divorced now because of this disease. What do I do to pull myself up by the breeches and just make it happen, go through the actual steps rather than just sit around and, go listen to the meetings and not, what do I do to, really do the work, steps 4 and 8, the writing and stuff like that?
Well, look, for the kind of work that you have to do in the program, that's something that should come from other members in the program, and particularly from your sponsor. But as I pointed out before, in addition to recovering from our addiction, right, we have to also focus on what do I want with my life? Right? I'm going to be here for 95 or 100 years. What do I want to have achieved with my life? Right? Now, that's a question that very few people ask themselves. There are people who have lived an entire lifespan without even having questioned what is my life for and what am I... Very interesting that a chassid once came to the first Rebbe of Lubavitch, Meir Zalman, and he gave him a petition outlining all of the things he asked and all the things that he needed. And Rebbe looked at the petition and he said, "It seems that you have given a lot of attention to your needs. How much attention have you given to why you are needed?" Right? Sometimes we become so absorbed in the kind of things that we need, the kind that we want, that we forget to take a look at, why am I on earth? What am I supposed to do with my existence? Right? That's a existential question, but I think it's one that we should ask ourselves and not allow our preoccupation with anything else to deviate us from looking for a goal and outcome for ourselves and for our existence.
All right. Perhaps, will the rabbi allow another question?
Yes. Hello?
I have a question. It's Danny.
Yes, go ahead.
Go ahead. I understand stop overthinking and overanalyzing things, that it will help me to overcome the addiction, or at least it will help me through it. But at the same time, I have this voice in my head that says, if I calm down, I'm not going to accomplish what I want to accomplish in life. So how do we...
I didn't get the question quite clearly because there's been some static on the line. I think you've got to be careful about the voices in your head. Because one alcoholic said to me, he said, I am envious of people who have a double personality. He says, because I had 16 personalities in my head. There were 16 voices in my head, and all of them were saying, go take a drink, go take a drink, go take a drink. And then I finally decided, I'm chairman of the board. I don't have to do what they say. Right? So... I'm not sure that I got your question, but the thing is that we have to realize that we are the masters of our lives, and we can and should steer the course we have, and not allow anything to deviate us from.
Dr. Tversky, the question was the difference being calm and worrying that if I'm calm, I won't accomplish what I want to accomplish.
Well, obviously,
by being
you've got to be
too
careful.
Calm.
That being calm does not slip into being a couch potato. There's an excess. About half of the book of Proverbs is the wise King Solomon talking about the dangers of indolence. And one might say, well, a lazy person is trying to keep calm. Yeah, and a lazy person is not trying to keep calm. He's just escaping the reality of what one has to do with his life. So, yes. Paralyzing anxiety can be bad, but a total calmness will lead one to inactivity. So stress can be healthy, right? There's a book written by Selye where he talks about stress without distress, right? We all need some stress to get moving, right? And without any stress at all, we'd probably lay in bed all day. So don't allow calmness to become a kind of thing that becomes the... Forget. You can be very calm with OxyContin. Be very calm with sleeping pills. You're very calm with tranquilizers. But that is not the, it's certainly not a healthy kind of calmness. Right? The kind of calmness where I'm going to do what I have to do and look for the security and the strength to do it with and have the good faith and belief that I can achieve, that's the kind of calmness that's constructive. Listen, I've got to sign off now because I have a doctor's
appointment. Can I ask one quick question?
Yes, yes.
I wanted to know, does someone have to stay in meetings for the rest of their life in order to really be okay?
Let me answer that question very briefly. I started going to meetings in 1961, even though I never drank. I recognized that the value of the program was not because of alcohol or drugs or anything else. The value of the program is in helping me overcome my character defects and become a better person. Therefore, when somebody asks me, how long do I have to go to the meetings? I say, as long as you still have character defects. When you no longer have any character defects, you can stop. But you won't have any problem doing that because if you no longer have character defects, you'll be dead. Every human being has character defects. Now, I have character defects, and that's why I still go to meetings. Fortunately, they're not the same defects that I had for 52 years ago. Right? But I still have character defects that I have to work on. So,
Rabbi,
as long as we have character defects, we go to meetings.
Rabbi, I have a question.
I know there's plenty of questions to be asked. You're welcome to send them to livetchaim@gmail.com, and I can forward them, and we'll see if the rabbi has time to answer. He has to go to an appointment. Rabbi, speaking on behalf of everybody here, your words were so inspiring. They went right to the heart. The message came across very loud and clear. We should all be zoche to continue to grow, work on our character defects, build Klal Yisrael, and all be Avdei Hashem.
Thank you.
Amen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
well.
You.
David Chaim. David Chaim, how do we get the recording of the shir?